Generally, our Meet the Professors sessions are split into two segments with two different faculty members. In this case, both of the professors for the second sessions sat in on the first session, and as the cases proceeded, I couldn't resist calling on Drs. Valero and Shablowski. The next case was presented by Dr. Howard Abel.
This lady was age 49 in March 1988 when she was found to have a 1 centimeter infiltrating ductal carcinoma, ER and PR positive. She had undergone TAH and BSO 6 years previously, and she was on Premarin and methyl testosterone at the time of diagnosis. She had implants, a lumpectomy was not advised, she had a modified radical mastectomy, and negative nodes. She was treated with postoperative tamoxifen. The data justifying treatment in node-negative disease had just become available. In January 2003, that's 15 years later, she developed bilateral pleuritic chest pain. A chest CT showed left axillary adenopathy. A needle biopsy identified metastatic adenocarcinoma. A bone scan was positive. Arimidex was begun in March 2003. There was complete resolution of pain by early June 2003, and the 27-29 marker had decreased from 120 to 38 units. In early October 2004, in the context of a progressively rising marker, Arimidex was discontinued. The patient was treated with Faslodex, 3 doses. The marker continued to rise, the 27-29, 72, 95, 115 units. Faslodex was discontinued, and the patient was treated with Aromacin, and after 3 months, there was no benefit on Aromacin.
And what was her clinical condition at that point?
Satisfactory. She has chronic lung disease from smoking, somewhat impaired in her function by the chronic lung disease. That's the only other comorbidity.
And where exactly is the tumor located now, and does she have tumor-related symptoms?
No tumor-related symptoms. There are osseous metastases. This is a positive bone scan.
The first thing I wanted to just talk about before we talk about what you might want to consider at this point is just the natural history of breast cancer and how we're looking at it at this point. This is fascinating. This is also interesting historically. This is the first wave of women in 1988 who got tamoxifen and actually chemotherapy, although she didn't receive it, for node-negative disease. And then she got it for 5 years. And then she relapsed 10 years after completing the tamoxifen. And John, I'm curious about your reflections about this case, the issue of late recurrence, and what you think about the evolving data from the MA17 trial, and whether or not, for example, you know, this is the ultimate Monday morning quarterbacking, I would say that in 2002, if she had had letrozole or an AI, she wouldn't have relapsed.
Well, I think that this is an extraordinarily good reason why we don't talk about breast cancer cure in the clinic, even though that's what everyone wants to hear, and they may have their 5-year celebration, but we all know that these late relapses do happen. And I think in this case that it does point out the unmet need that 5 years of tamoxifen is probably insufficient for the ER-positive population. In this woman, she was postmenopausal when she started her TAM. If we were to see her today, of course, we would integrate an AI. And if we were seeing her after completing 5 years of TAM, the data is there for letrozole, and there's only a small data set for anastrozole in that setting. So we would routinely recommend letrozole. What's particularly interesting was that at San Antonio, there was an analysis done on those women on the MA17 trial who had been randomized to placebo. And then at the time that the data came out, they were offered the ability to go on open-label letrozole in an adjuvant setting, even though they've had a treatment-free interval much more than the 3 months mandated by the trial. And the analysis presented at San Antonio suggested that those women who went on to letrozole, even though it was sort of a late extended or a deferred extended letrozole, let's say, did much better than those women who chose not to go on the letrozole. In fact, there was a survival signal when multivariate analysis was done in an attempt to correct for the baseline differences in the population. I would just suggest to you that there's no biological reason why that signal isn't real, that it's probable that these women, a portion of them have micrometastatic disease that could be suppressed by an AI and would be doing better with that. But I just have concerns about the trial design. In the cardiology literature, people who are non-compliant with their placebos die more frequently than people who are compliant with their placebos. It's a known fact that if you take people who are the kind that seek medical attention and follow what their doctor's orders are and take recommendations, that they will live longer. And it's hard to adjust for that on multivariate analysis. And so the fact that the late extended adjuvant letrozole outperformed extended letrozole would suggest to me there's a huge bias in that analysis. And so just be cautious when you tell women, even if they've been off tamoxifen for some years, that putting them back on would give them a survival advantage.
Cliff, I actually interviewed Paul Goss, who presented these data in San Antonio, and I asked him, are we moving towards a situation where when we see a woman like this in follow-up, who's 5, 10 years past 5 years of tamoxifen and doing well, that we should be thinking about an aromatase inhibitor? And he said, yeah, not that we're ready for that right now in terms of clinical trial evidence, but that in terms of this concept that John was talking about, that maybe we should start thinking about it and looking at that. And I know, Cliff, you're hoping to look at that question using fulvestrant. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's something we've actually been circling already this afternoon a few times, and it's about hazard rates and natural history. And so what all this data is reminding us of, again, is that there's a chronic, unremitting risk of recurrence for ER positives. And I always describe it to patients as a fixed rate mortgage, where the interest rate doesn't change year after year after year. That's the rate of recurrence. For ER-negative disease, it's like a bad adjustable rate mortgage where you have a big balloon up front and then the rate drops tremendously. So for these patients who, you have to imagine them biologically, have got microscopic metastatic disease that's popping up clinically at a very regular rate, intervening with an active therapy compared to not intervening should, at any point in time, lower their risk of recurrence, if it's effective therapy. What we don't have is data for that, but we indirectly are gaining it. For example, it doesn't actually seem to matter when you start an aromatase inhibitor compared to tamoxifen for 5 years. In each of the three scenarios tested, up front, in the middle, and out back, you nudge the hazards in a favorable direction. Similarly, as you know, MA17 is now being re-randomized for the second 5 years, meaning the third 5 years of treatment, years 11 to 15, and there's obviously a hypothesis that more therapy at that point will continue to nudge the hazards. So with all that as background, we have a hypothesis right now that if we were to intervene with effective hormone therapy for patients who still have risk of recurrence, independent of when they finish their treatment, we should be able to demonstrate a reduction. And what we hope to do is offer fulvestrant to patients for 2 years at some point beginning after they have finished standard adjuvant therapy for 5 years, and demonstrate that the hazards of recurrence go down. And the notion here, the hope is that we will prove the principle rather than the specific. And that would allow you to then see the patient who wanders in from the outback and says, gee, my doc didn't give me hormone therapy for the last 4 years, and should I have had it? And if we had a positive result, our answer could then be a definitive yes.
As you've been talking about this trial, a lot of the trials right now in fulvestrant are using loading doses. Are you planning on doing that?
Yeah, for this trial, we're still talking about it because we're not acutely treating established disease, and so an immediate or early response wouldn't necessarily be a requirement here. And I hasten to add, our focus on fulvestrant is our assumption going forward that most of our candidate patients will have already been on AIs and stopped them.
And in a treatment situation, when you're treating metastatic disease, how do you approach the initial dosing?
Well, without randomized data proving that the loading dose is better, but considering the risk to benefit for patients, we actually are in the direction of using a loading dose right now. So we give the 500 milligram dose as a first injection. Sometimes we give a day 14 injection as well and then proceed to monthly treatment.
I'm curious, John, with the kinds of restrictions you have in Canada, how do you approach dosing for fulvestrant?
Well, we tend to stick to the package insert dose. Currently, believe it or not, Faslodex is not approved in Canada for use, so we're getting it through a compassionate drug release program. And so the only way we can get it is at the package insert dose, or soon-to-be package insert dose of 250. Once it's marketed, then we'll have more flexibility.
Interesting. So what I'd like to do now is come to the next point in time. She's had tamoxifen, anastrozole had a really good response, fulvestrant, and exemestane, correct? And it sounds like at that point you had decided that she was not going to respond to hormones, at least at that point?
That is correct.
Okay, so Cliff, let's think through this situation in terms of chemotherapy for this woman. Now, she at that point would be a 66-year-old woman with asymptomatic, metastatic, hormone-resistant disease, Cliff.
Well, at the risk of putting a wrench in the system, I'll answer your question first, but I want to just highlight that right now, if, unless I'm misunderstanding you, we're being driven to treatment decisions by a blood test.
Correct.
But she has in terms of progression.
She has established disease, but I haven't heard that she had imaging that showed progression of disease.
Probably not, no. The imaging has not shown progression. That is correct.
So as you've been following her through this various hormones, she's been asymptomatic?
After the pain was initially treated, yes.
And there was no objective changes?
Correct.
And so you're basically deciding on progression based on markers?
That is right.
Okay, Cliff. Go for it, but I still want to know what you would do in terms of chemotherapy.
I will. So I will say one thing is that I would not treat those blood tests. I would worry about them. I would gnaw my fingernails over them, and I wouldn't have necessarily changed her therapy in response to them. They would have simply provoked me to keep looking harder and harder for objective evidence of progression. I don't doubt that she really has progressive disease that's minimal. But the goal of therapy for stage 4 disease remains palliation, and ideally in this case you want to swoop in with your palliative therapy, your new therapy, right before she was going to become symptomatic, whenever that is. And right now there's no hint that she's got objective progression. Let me push it one step further. You could practice in a world or a community that didn't pay for or allow you to do markers, in which case you'd be back on your first hormone therapy for her stage 4 disease, which might be just as well.
Unless by giving her the hormone sequentially over these years, he actually prevented her from developing problems.
We don't know, but it's tough to justify treatment changes based on those blood tests.
Yeah, this is an important issue to examine further. I don't see any point in waiting for her to become symptomatic. The markers are telling you something. They're telling you that your treatment is ineffective. So perhaps at the best, if you don't begin another treatment, maybe you should stop what you're doing. On the other hand, you're simply waiting for her to become symptomatic. The nature of her disease is such that the imaging studies are not likely to be terribly helpful, and she was rather severely symptomatic in early 03 with the first appearance of metastatic disease. Now, by analogy with other diseases where we don't have something, a tumor size to measure ovarian cancer, we do make our decisions on the basis of the marker. Testicular cancer would be a similar story. So, yeah, this is an issue.
This is always guaranteed to create like a 4-hour controversy, so I'm going to try to limit to about 3 more minutes.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. I mean, there are subtle differences here, and so you're with the patient and you're looking at her, and all your points are entirely valid. The dilemma is that soon we'll be inflicting the toxicity of chemotherapy on a patient who no doubt will need it sooner or later, but maybe could have waited till later. And I don't know when that is.
Hold on, before we sort of move off the tumor markers, just to get John's take on that. Do you agree with Cliff's point of view? Or there are probably at least half of oncologists in practice, and I think probably a substantial number of clinical researchers who have this kind of approach, believing in markers in metastatic disease. What are your thoughts?
Well, I tend to be one of the unbelievers in markers in breast cancer. And I say that even though one of the companies, Biomira, is an Edmonton-based company that's producing your marker, and they don't invite me to their advisory boards. But at the end of the day, I think most of the clinical trials that have been done that guide our practice have almost universally been done without markers, which is why it's such an open question. And I'm not saying it's wrong, it's just untested. And so my preference is to wait for objective evidence of some type before switching off of potentially effective hormonal therapy.
So Cliff, she's got 2 new lesions on bone scan with X-ray correlation. Now what?
So this person at some point needs chemotherapy. I'm not even sure this is it. I have to say one more thing. With a 15-year interval or more from when she was first diagnosed, the growth curve of her kind of breast cancer is shallow enough that this is the kind of patient where I might find myself reusing tamoxifen. I might find myself trying estrogens. I might try megase. I might do everything I could when she's asymptomatic to get through hormone therapy. But I will stipulate that we've been through all that. When it's time for chemotherapy, I would not follow the normal algorithm, and this is the exact kind of patient where I would start with oral chemotherapy with capecitabine. And the reason I would do that is it would represent for her, in many ways, a less toxic alternative again. And the therapy she gets first, statistically, is the therapy she's likeliest to be on longest. And again, the toxicity profile for that, without alopecia, without significant myelosuppression, would represent for me an advantage over conventionals or other cytotoxic agents. But I would quickly add, if somebody said, well, I would use weekly paclitaxel, or I would use docetaxel, or I would use anthracyclines, or gemcitabine, or vinorelbine, there is no firm case to be made in any direction. What I'm presenting to you is a biased view based on my assessment of the toxicity profiles.
Putting aside reimbursement, Cliff, capecitabine alone or with bevacizumab?
So again, there's no data for first-line capecitabine with bevacizumab, but in fact, when I give first-line chemotherapy in the stage 4 setting, I routinely try to use bevacizumab now based on the ECOG 2100 trial. That they used paclitaxel to me is sort of a non-issue because bevacizumab in general is used with almost every chemotherapy agent across a variety of diseases, so I don't have particular concerns about interactions, both favorable or unfavorable. There is safety data for bevacizumab plus capecitabine from Kathy Miller's trial in the salvage setting, and despite the labeling of that trial as negative, in fact, it had clear biologic signals of increased activity. So if the patient had no contraindication and was starting first-line chemo and is HER2 normal, we routinely try to use bevacizumab.
Dose and schedule of capecitabine and bevacizumab in your regimen.
So again, two options. Usually we start with the standard schedule of 3-week cycles, 14 days on. We use a lower than standard dose. At least we aim for 2,000 milligrams per meter squared. We are studying on our service right now a week on, week off schedule, which in fact is used in other diseases and is used by clinicians anecdotally, but hasn't been formally tested in breast cancer. We've been dose escalating this using flat dosing in a phase 1 setting, and we're going into phase 2 shortly.
Dose and schedule the bevacizumab?
Again, I would match it for convenience to the patient's regimen. If she's getting Q3 visits for initiation of capecitabine, then I would give her 15 per a kilo every third week of bevacizumab and so on.
John, reimbursement, cost, regulatory issues aside, what do you think the best therapy would be for this woman in this situation?
Well, first of all, I just wanted to confirm she's had bisphosphonate therapy
yes.
as well?
Okay. Yes.
And she is HER2 negative?
Yes, we checked that.
Okay. Well, I would agree that actually recycling the hormones might be a very valid option in this lady. It's been years since she's been exposed to tamoxifen. Megase is not a fun drug, but nonetheless, it could be considered as an option. If I were to use first-line chemotherapy, I would use naked Xeloda at 2,000 milligrams per meter squared, 2 weeks on, 1 week off. And bevacizumab is a pipe dream in Canada. And for those of you who know about our biggest export from British Columbia, you might know what I mean. But at the end of the day, we are not in a position, either from approval standpoint or financial standpoint, to be giving bevacizumab for metastatic breast cancer in the absence of survival advantage. Basically, our regulatory agencies require OS before they'll move on approval of expensive new therapies.
If you taxed British Columbia's exports, you'd probably be able to afford it.
You may be right. Or the Canadian solution would be to nationalize the industry.
Did you have a question over Scott?
It goes back to Dr. Abel's just description of this case, and for me, it just didn't smell right. This lady burned through 3 hormonal therapies in a matter of 2 to 3 years after having a 15-year disease-free interval. And so I got the sense that either we weren't measuring her response to those therapies as accurately as we should have. In other words, we were discarding therapies that were deemed as ineffective and maybe they weren't effective, or there's clearly something different about the biology of her disease today than when she was first diagnosed. And, you know, John asked the question of HER2 new testing. I mean, has she been re-biopsied? And
it was done on the specimen from the left axillary node.
Okay. And then is 3 months enough time to give Faslodex a chance to know if it's working or not working? Can you abandon Faslodex after 3 months?
Cliff?
Yeah, these are complicated questions. First of all, if you go back to, I think, Dan Hayes, who did some of the initial work with 15-3, and you look at CEA, both as markers for progression, everything everybody believes is true. They do predict progression, but the problem is, if I remember correctly, the time to progression clinically can be out to 7 months or longer from when the marker goes up. So it's an early look at an inevitability. And the challenge is to prove that early intervention in that setting makes a difference. And you have a lot of evidence that says it doesn't. For example, early detection of metastatic disease right now in 2 randomized trials from the 1990s doesn't lead to an improved outcome. By extension, early response to an inevitable future progression of disease may not improve outcomes despite everybody's hopes to the contrary. The second issue that I wanted to get at is in terms of duration of treatment. From bone scan data, at least, we know that early looks at disease status after you begin a new hormone therapy can be misleading for sure. For example, bone scans in particular can actually look worse, and we have reasonable evidence that blood tests can actually spike and fall markers in response to a new hormone therapy. And so, again, 3 months is a little long for that, still to be true, by the way. But, again, in a patient with no symptoms, one would be tempted to hold tight and see what the shape of the curve is for the markers. Maybe she was going to spike and drop.
I want to go back to John about this case. We understand in terms of access to bevacizumab, but we're interested in your view of the science and the potential clinical applicability. So you treat this woman with capecitabine. She does well, has a nice response, let's say for a year, for example, then progresses. Then what?
Well, then we're looking at second-line chemotherapy, and there are a number of relatively gentle options. If she's still minimally symptomatic, then we like to use, in Canada, monotherapy. If a person's asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic and relatively slow pace of disease. However, in this case, you could also make an argument for combination therapy if she has had only 1 year of benefit from the taxane. I mean, that's better than average, but at the end of the day, if she were highly symptomatic or had visceral disease at that point, then we'd go into combinations. It's not clear from my reading that there's any particular advantage to sequencing the anthracyclines before or after the taxanes, but she is anthracycline naive and taxane naive. You've got a lot of options for her. The more gentle options, though, are things like vinorelbine, although response rates are probably less. Single-agent gemcitabine, if you're going to use monotherapy, is a very well-tolerated regimen. In some patients, even weekly epirubicin can be remarkably well-tolerated for a long time.
If you're in a situation where you're using a taxane first line, let's just say paclitaxel, again, putting aside the reimbursement issue, do you think that bevacizumab should be added in?
Well, at present with paclitaxel, in the best of all worlds, yes, I'd give weekly paclitaxel and bevacizumab if I were going to be giving weekly paclitaxel. I think the data is quite strong with the time to progression being very robust. It's a little early to say whether overall survival will be shifted or not. I think with further follow-up, we may see that. However, at present, the most recent analysis does not quite reach a statistically significant level of overall survival benefit, and so it's just harder to leverage those kind of drugs into the clinic.
Well, if we'll say that you use the capecitabine and Avastin, and then she had a 2-year response, but then progresses.
So what do I do next?
Yep.
It's the same issue. You know, I weigh at that time her tumor burden and her symptoms against the toxicity profiles of the various drugs. And if she's got still an indolent disease pattern, I would go with one of the single-agent chemotherapy regimens. And I don't have a strong bias for any of them, frankly, and I can't work myself up to say that there's only one choice. Normally, what do? We tend to use weekly paclitaxel, we tend to use vinorelbine, we tend to use gemcitabine, and the order is sort of close to random.
Could you work yourself up to keeping the bevacizumab going?
I can't do that right now. The fact of the matter is that this is a tumor. Again, it goes a little bit to the biology of this, and while there's endless debate about trastuzumab beyond progression of disease, that's the sort of frame of reference here. If a cancer is able to grow despite years of VEGF ligand blockade, one has to speculate that this tumor is growing independent of that treatment. And it's a treatment with some toxicities and with expense and no evidence whatsoever to suggest that you should use it beyond progression. So we would endeavor not to do that.
Okay, I want to just finish up with this case, Dr. Abel. Now, the point at which she progressed on the aromasin was when, date-wise, so to speak?
Probably almost a year ago, I would think.
So she was treated before the bevacizumab data came out.
Yes.
And what did you treat her with?
She got single-agent Xeloda.
What happened?
She's done well to the present time.
What happened to her markers?
Down and staying down.
What dose did you use and how did she tolerate it?
2,000 milligrams per meter squared and tolerated very well.
So she stays like this for a while, Cliff, and then progresses and comes to you. Would you add in bevacizumab on top of it?
You mean once she's progressed on the capecitabine?
Mm-hmm.
No, I would change the chemotherapy and add bevacizumab.
Okay. Dr. Abel?
Yeah, let me just ask if there's a conflict in the concept here between advocating late extended adjuvant but not treating the tumor marker. Is that conceptually coherent?
Well, I think so because the patient population is quite different. In the extended adjuvant setting, overwhelmingly you're dealing with patients who are cured, so your toxicity profile has to matter a whole lot. In the metastatic setting where you're talking about, you're palliating patients who are all going to die of their disease and their quality of life is their paramount issue. So I actually don't think that they're the same at all.
Dr. Kuser, did you have a question?
Well, I was going to say a comment also about waiting till the patient is symptomatic. You know, it may be a little bit too late. And from my experience, most patients with bone disease only, when they become symptomatic, even if you have effective therapy, they'll still be symptomatic. So, you know, I don't see a big sin by following the markers as a guide for changing your therapy. I mean, I have a lady in a wheelchair that I waited till she became symptomatic and, you know, radiation and chemo and everything, and she's still symptomatic.
So for every anecdote, there will be the opposite. And there's the patient who I've taken out of the wheelchair with hormone therapy who went 5 years, right? so recovers from that.
Yeah, but when you have a compression fracture...
Let me be very clear. I'm not advocating waiting till they're symptomatic. What I'm advocating is waiting till there's objective evidence of something other than the blood test. That's the key difference. Because the dilemma is, while in this case it worked nicely if you're using the blood test as a marker, objectively, the question is, have you prolonged her survival? Well, that's tough to prove. Objectively, have you improved her quality of life? That's a really tough one to prove. And those are the real endpoints, I think, for stage 4 management right now. The world will change one day. There'll be curative therapy, I believe, for stage 4 disease, and then jumping on this will matter more than it does right now. I want to give one more inch back, though. There's no question that for difficult-to-evaluate disease, sometimes the blood marker is really all you have to go by. That's true. But still in all, one should be very conservative about burning up a whole lot of therapy in asymptomatic patients.
Dr. Dragon?
So I have one question, but I only want to say PET scan is another option.
If you did it at the beginning, then it's useful.
So you already answered my first question. If you gave the bevacizumab with the Xeloda, you wouldn't give it with the taxane.
Personally, I
would
not.
So you could do it in the opposite sequence and wait. But the question I have, could you walk through the absolute benefit for a population similar to Dr. Abel's patient, T1B, and then the T1C population for giving the aromatase inhibitor after 5 years, in terms of explaining this to patients, rather than saying you have a 40% risk reduction, what is the absolute benefit for that population of a T1B or a T1C N0 population to get 5 years of aromatase inhibitor and bone density and et cetera?
Actually, I want to let Rowan jump in on that one.
When you look at the numbers, it looks like half the recurrences are yet to come. And so basically the easiest way for me to figure it out now, where we're waiting for data, is that the same argument you made when you decided to give the therapy initially applies now for at least the breast cancer risk reduction. Now that leaves unstated, and we'll see the data, and you know, everybody has perhaps different interpretations about the toxicity profile, but for the risk reduction, it seems like the same numbers should apply but spread out over 10 years.
The numbers that I've heard, actually I think Paul Goss told me this, and this does include contralateral, so you can take that for what it's worth, was sort of ballpark 2% a year. I guess this is from year 5 to 15 for node negative patients originally, 4% a year for node positive. Do you guys buy into those numbers?
Seems a little bit
too high.
Yeah. Is this with treatment or without?
Without treatment.
Still seems high.
Recurrence risk?
Well, it includes contralateral, which is 0.6, but it's mostly recurrence.
You do the adjuvant online system, and you can calculate in a patient that there is a T1A, T1B, you calculate the absolute of that therapy will come about 2%. So I have done it a couple of times. And
2% total?
Total.
Right.
Over what period of time?
Over what the data has produced
right.
So far.
But I mean, for practical purposes, Cliff, a woman comes into you like this, who's 5 years past her tamoxifen, and says, what's the chance over the next 5 years I'm going to have a relapse?
Well, I actually answer like Rowan does. I say it's about the same as when you first came in.
So what's the number?
Well, which tumor size are we talking about exactly?
Well, you can do it with each one. Let's try with T1B, a 1 centimeter tumor.
Yeah, you know, it's for ER positive in that size, node negative, it's probably in the 6 to 10% range over the next 5 years.
Sounds like 2% a year to me almost.
Yeah. Close.
And we can't get much lower than that, I don't think. I mean, you know, basically because you get these real small tumors and then you run out of numbers.
Okay, same question. She had 3 positive nodes originally.
But the positive makes it easier on all counts because in the MA17, the planned analysis for node positive patients shows a survival advantage.
I'm just looking at it in terms of trying to come up with some, we're getting used because of the adjuvant model to giving people absolute risk numbers and absolute risk reduction.
Some of us.
Okay, some of us. A lot of us.
Well, no, I mean, you know, before we go past this point, for the powerful value of the adjuvant online, it does suffer a few limits. For example, it lumps together your 1.1 and your 1.9 centimeter breast cancers, and they're not the same risk.
Granted. Again, 3 positive nodes.
Well, that drives the day then, you know.
Okay, 3 positive nodes. The lady's 5 years past her tamoxifen. She says, what's the chance I'm going to relapse over the next 5 years?
So I would have initially said that with a 1 centimeter tumor and 3 involved lymph nodes, that her 5-year risk would have been probably up around 20 to 25%. And I would say that her risk in the next 5 years is probably pretty close to that.
That's a little bit close to 4% a year, too, also.
Sure.
Do we really have good numbers on this, Rowan?
No, and I think the idea is that I think the toxicity business comes into play here because these numbers are the numbers we're going to be dealing with all the time now. When you're looking for the 10 node positive people, those are the old days. I mean, in the Women's Health Initiative, where we're doing mammograms every year, we get 1.5 centimeter tumors, and instead of the expected 30% or so node positive, we get 15% node positive. That's our reality in the future. We talk about who benefits from Herceptin. If you're a big believer in node positive versus node negative, you're going to have no data set in the future because all the node positive studies are going to have no patients. So we're going to be dealing with these low-risk populations from now on, and I think the story is going to be the toxicity story. Because efficacy is pretty clear.
Interesting public health question. What fraction of women who die of breast cancer, let's say over the next couple of years, had node negative disease originally?
It's going to go up.
Yeah, it has to go up.
A lot of the women dying of breast cancer had node negative mammographically detected disease because there are so many of them.
And I think we're at a transition point that many people don't realize is in MAP3, where we're looking at XMS stain versus placebo, we're entering 4,300 women, and they're not BRCA1-2 carriers. They're 60-year-old women. And so basically what's happened is the therapies are so powerful, we have sample size based on an expectation of 70% breast cancer risk reduction, and it's crossing with our adjuvant trials. Our adjuvant trials are bigger, and the risk, those, albeit for metastatic disease versus primary disease, are about the same or maybe even less. And so the toxicity question really is going to be a big deal.
This concludes the first CD. For more from Meet the Professors, please turn to the second CD.